This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I am David Vandy, and here's what's coming up tonight.
Israel has increased its ground incursion. Israeli tanks and troops overnight went into northern Gaza further, getting to the outskirts of Gaza City. However, this is still not the widespread ground invasion that Israeli officials have been talking about.
That's reporter Linda Gradstein on the status of the Israel-Hamas conflict after Israel began its expected ground assault. Also, a proposed law in Nigeria would give the government power to regulate digital platforms. And South Africa is celebrating its fourth title at the Rugby World Cup. All these and more coming up on African News Tonight. Later today, the United Nations Security Council meets on Israel's ground incursion in Gaza and the humanitarian plight of Palestinians. The United Arab Emirates asked for the emergency meeting and intends to present a resolution calling for an immediate pause in the fighting to allow more aid into the Gaza Strip. Aid workers say the humanitarian situation is increasingly dire. Israel imposed a blockade of food, fuel, and supplies into the territory after Hamas fighters attacked Israeli communities on October 7th. United Nations officials and several governments have repeatedly called for a pause in the fighting to let aid into Gaza. Yesterday, U.S. President Joe Biden urged Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to significantly increase the flow of aid. The Hamas-run health ministry says more than 8,000 Gaza residents have died in the fighting. In the occupied West Bank, more than 110 Palestinians have been killed in violence and Israeli raids. More than 1,400 people in Israel have been killed, most of them slain in the initial Hamas attack. In addition, Hamas took at least 239 hostages into Gaza. For more on the United Nations meeting today, we have VOA's United Nations correspondent Margaret Bashir on the line from New York. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Margaret.
Thanks for having me.
So, Margaret, what is the latest from the United Nations on the humanitarian impact of the conflict?
Well, they're saying it's a humanitarian catastrophe in the making. Aid is not getting in. There are more than 2.2 million people in the Gaza Strip, and only about 80 trucks, by the UN's count, have gone in the past week when Israel started to allow aid, limited aid, to go in. We saw 33 trucks go in on Sunday. They had food, water, and medical supplies. They crossed through Egypt's Rafah crossing, but that's the most trucks that have gone in a single day so far. But they don't have any fuel on them. That's important to say because the UN has been warning that its humanitarian assistance to people, its operations, are slowly being crippled by the lack of fuel. They need fuel to run the aid convoys. You know, the convoys go in with a full tank into Gaza, but they've got to get out of Gaza, and they need to distribute their supplies to people there. They also need it to give it to bakeries that they work with to produce bread. Some people are only getting one piece of bread a day. And they need it for hospitals, for generators, for babies on life support, and other people who are ill and who need surgeries and such. So it's been a real challenge. We saw on Sunday that the UN said thousands of desperate Palestinians broke into one of their supply warehouses in Gaza and stole supplies. Food is running out in the public markets. So people are panicking.
And so what does the United Nations say that is actually needed in Gaza?
Well, the first priority of the Secretary General is to have a humanitarian ceasefire. The UN says this is the only way that they can safely get the amount of aid that is needed into Gaza. And they need to do it every day. You know, they just can't go one or two times. They need it to be a sustained, large-scale aid operation. But for that, they need some security for their people. The UN Relief and Works Agency, which works with the Palestinian refugees in Gaza, they have 13,000 staff there. They have confirmed 63 of them have died in the bombings so far. So it's a very difficult, insecure situation for aid workers. And the UN needs to see this remedied. The UN shelters are vastly overcrowded with people. Israel gave an order at the beginning of the hostilities for people to evacuate to southern Gaza. They did, but now we have more than 1.4 million people displaced. And it's been a very difficult situation for the UN.
So tell us, what's expected at this Emergency Security Council meeting later today?
So as you mentioned, the United Arab Emirates, which is on the Security Council, they called for the meeting after Israel expanded its ground operations on Friday night. The council will be briefed by the head of the UN Relief and Works Agency, Mr. Philippe Lazzarini. He will talk about the situation, the humanitarian situation. His agency is perpetually underfunded. And now their staff are trying to protect their own families in the conflict as they continue to work. It's he and the Secretary General have said that the staff at UNRWA are real heroes in this war. In relation to a resolution, the council has tried four times to adopt various versions of the same resolution calling for some sort of humanitarian pause, but so far they've failed to reach the necessary levels of agreement and support. On Friday, the UN General Assembly said, "We're tired of you guys, you know, not accomplishing anything, so we're taking over." And they adopted their own resolution overwhelmingly calling for humanitarian truce so that aid could go in. But this is not a legally binding resolution. It's only the will of the international community behind it. So now the Security Council is considering a fifth possible resolution, a draft. It's in negotiations. We don't expect a vote today. But the really sad reality is that any UN resolution is unlikely to stop the continuation of this conflict.
Thank you very much, Margaret.
Thank you.
That was VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir in New York. Israel is expanding its military assault deeper into the northern Gaza Strip as the United Nations and medical staff expressed fears over airstrikes hitting closer to hospitals where tens of thousands of Palestinians have sought shelter. The Hamas-run health ministry says more than 8,000 Gaza residents have died in the fighting, which began after Hamas militants assaulted communities in Israel on October 7th. In the occupied West Bank, more than 110 Palestinians have been killed in violence and Israeli raids. More than 1,400 people in Israel have been killed, most of them slain in the initial Hamas attacks. In addition, Hamas took at least 239 hostages into Gaza. Earlier today, my colleague Paul Alexander spoke with reporter Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. They started by talking about the increased Israeli offensive into Gaza.
First of all, as you said, Israel has increased its ground incursion. Israeli tanks and troops overnight went into northern Gaza further, getting to the outskirts of Gaza City. However, this is still not the widespread ground invasion that Israeli officials have been talking about. Hamas has thousands of fighters in a network of tunnels beneath the ground. Israel says that in this overnight fighting, it killed several dozen Hamas gunmen who were hiding in buildings, and it caused, at the same time, the air campaign continued, and whole neighborhoods in northern Gaza, especially in, outside of Gaza City, have been just totally destroyed. We do have another development recently in the last couple of hours, which is that Hamas on a Hamas channel of Telegram released a video of three Israeli hostages, three women, all three of them middle-aged women, castigating the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for getting them, into the situation, saying it was his fault that they were kidnapped by Hamas, that he hasn't run the country, and saying he should do more to get them freed. The women looked healthy. Netanyahu called the video propaganda.
The Israeli offensive into Gaza appears to be gradual instead of a single full-on invasion. What are defense officials there saying about it?
Well, the thing is that any, full-on ground invasion is going to be very complicated and is going to cause a lot of life on both sides. So Israel says that it is combining a gradual ground invasion with a continual aerial bombing of all kinds of Hamas targets. Over the weekend, Israel released evidence that it's shared with, intelligence services that it says shows that Hamas is using hospitals as command and control centers and have bunkers underneath all the hospitals. And as you said in the introduction, tens of thousands of Palestinians are sheltering in hospitals. The World Health Organization said that a third of the hospitals are already not functioning. One of these hospitals, the Al-Quds Hospital, received warnings from Israel that it should evacuate all of the patients and anyone sheltering there should leave, meaning that Israel is planning to bomb that hospital. That hasn't happened yet, although there have been Israeli bombings nearby, and most of the people sheltering there say they feel that they have no place to go, so they're not going to leave.
That was journalist Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. She spoke with VOA's Paul Alexander in Washington earlier today. Nigerian authorities are seeking to pass a law that would give the government power to regulate platforms, digital platforms across the country. Supporters say social media has been used to spread falsehood that threatens lives and properties. But opponents say it's an attempt to stifle free speech and dissenting opinions. Timothy Obiozu has the story from the capital, Abuja.
For the past 6 years, Chude Nnamdi has made a name for himself on social media by commenting on national issues such as police brutality. Nnamdi has more than 260,000 followers on X, formerly known as Twitter.
I participated, we planned, we did a whole lot of things, and after that, I got my connection enlarged. I got to know a whole lot of other social media activists.
But as his fame on social media grew, so did the challenges. In March, Nnamdi was arrested by Nigeria's Department of State Services, or DSS, for his post about an influential businessman. Authorities accused Nnamdi of cyberbullying, defamation, and criminal intimidation. He had been held without charge for a week until activists protested and he was freed pending trial. Nnamdi says these days he feels in danger wherever he goes.
Aside my arrest by the police and the DSS, I've had so many challenges, threats to me, to my family. I don't just go to places because I know that people, I have so many enemies. When I mean serious enemies, there are people that will see me here today. They will like to kill me.
Nigerians are heavy users of social media, and they often take to digital platforms to criticize government policies and demand better governance. But Nigerian authorities argue that unregulated social media use has too often resulted in problems, including threats to security. This month, authorities introduced a bill that will give the National Broadcasting Commission rights to control social media platforms. Activists say it is an attempt to stifle free speech. Kola Wole Oluwadare is a deputy director at Nigeria's Socioeconomic Rights Accountability Project, or SERAP.
That is basically the reason, the underpinning of the various steps that are taken by various administrations, including the ones preceding this one, to regulate social media. And the fears and the concerns are public, that although the law may look well-meaning, the law may even be justified, but the use of those laws has been found with other legislations, including the cybercrime, that shows the propensity of the Nigerian authorities to use law, called well-meaning laws, as it were, to clamp down on human rights.
SERAP has petitioned the Nigerian government to drop the bill. In 2019, Nigeria shelved a bill to regulate social media after it led to street protests. But some citizens, like Abuja resident Gift Mweze, say the government may have a point.
Nigerians, they don't really know how to process information. So when they get these details, they go about social media saying and exaggerating the situation, thinking that maybe other countries have different story about the same situation. So if we are able to regulate what goes into the social media about this country, it's going to go a long way.
The bill has been read in Parliament, but will need a public hearing and the president's approval before it becomes law. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Nigerian authorities say more than 70 people are missing after a boat capsized in northern Taraba State. The boat was carrying traders returning from a fish market late Saturday when it capsized on the Benue River, which is one of Nigeria's largest. Boat disasters are common in remote communities across the West African nation. The Taraba State governor called the accident a monumental tragedy and ordered the use of life jackets for boat passengers. The Taraba police spokesperson said the rescue and recovery operation could last for days because the river is flowing at its highest level. You are listening to African News Tonight. I am David Vandy in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Ahead of a scheduled visit to Kenya by Britain's King Charles III and Queen Camilla, the Talai clan of the Kipsigis community is petitioning the king to help them receive compensation for the loss of land during the colonial period. The request comes amid United Nations criticism of the British government's unresolved colonial-era land disputes. Francis Omtumwa reports.
The picturesque highlands of Kericho County in Kenya's Rift Valley. But beneath the scenic rolling hills and sprawling tea estates are dark secrets deeply buried in the very soul of this community. When the British arrived in this part of the world, the Kipsigis community and the people of its Talai clan were evicted from their lands under the Crown Lands Ordinance of 1902, which essentially transferred ownership of their lands to the British.
Before the white man came, we were staying well with no problems with other people. Where my mother came from, we were all friends.
Kibore Cheruyot Ngasura is among the few surviving Talai elders who took part in the colonial resistance of the 1940s, which led to his detention by British colonizers. Today he is 106 years old and lives on the fringes of what was once his ancestral heaven on a piece of land he bought after he was freed. He will live to see Britain's new King Charles III make a state visit to Kenya from October the 31st to November the 3rd. Charles first to a Commonwealth nation since succeeding his mother, Queen Elizabeth II, last year.
King.
We welcome the king. He is welcome here, but he must remember the Talai people. We have gone through a hard time, and he should do something about it.
Clone.
Tito Arap Mitei is a former colonial-era prison warden.
We want back our property. We want back our property.
Kenya declared its independence from Britain in December of 1963. As Kenya gets ready to commemorate 60 years of independence, these peasant farmers have little cause for celebration, says Joel Kimeto, a leader and a scholar of the Kipsigis.
They should compensate us. And at the same time, they should now acknowledge and tell the Kenya government to revert back our Kipsigis ancestral lands, free of charge. We are not buying. When they came here, they did not buy.
In May 2021, United Nations Special Rapporteurs wrote to the UK government expressing concern about its failure to issue a public apology and provide reparations for the estimated 500,000 Kipsigis and Talai people who suffered under the British rule. The UK government said it issued an apology in 2013 and compensated Kenyans who lived through the emergency period and the Mau Mau insurgency and made claims. The Kipsigis and Talai note their complaint and case is separate. David Ngasura Tuwei is an advocate for the Kipsigis and the author of a book about them.
The objective of writing the book is to highlight the whole world. I want the whole world to know the plight of the Talai plus the Kipsigis, what the colonialists did to the Talai and Kipsigis people.
With Buckingham Palace saying in a statement that the king will acknowledge the more painful aspects of Britain and Kenya's shared history during his trip, there is hope that the visit could offer some semblance of historical closure. Francis Ontomua, VOA News, Kericho, Kenya.
Celebrations have continued in South Africa after the national rugby team, the Springboks, beat the All Stars of New Zealand 12-11 in the Rugby World Cup finals on Saturday. Thousands of Springbok supporters filled public viewing places, restaurants and bars across the country to watch their team rock to a tightly contested victory at the Stade de France in Saint-Denis, just outside Paris. As Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg, the fans say the victory celebrations will continue until the team lands at the Oliver Tambo International Airport tomorrow with a trophy in hand.
It's a win described by Springbok supporters as one of the toughest the team has ever won. Throughout the tournament, the team had to wrestle with rugby giants like Scotland, Ireland, France, England, before facing the feared three-time World Cup champion, the All Blacks of New Zealand, in the final. Chad Solbeck, who was on his feet throughout the entire 8 minutes, cheering the team with thousands of others at the Merrows Arch public viewing area in Johannesburg, shed tears of joy after the Springboks' victory.
I thought we would win, but I was hoping for more than 1 point. But listen, if there's a will, there's a way. We South African, we won.
Another Springboks fan, Minenhle Sibiya, said she could not believe her eyes when the referee blew the final whistle, with the team still clinging to their 1 point lead.
We are here in Merrows Arch. We love the place. We are happy for you, South Africa. Come back, come back. We are waiting for you. We love you, South Africa.
And President Cyril Ramaphosa, who flew to France to watch the final match, told the media that the Springboks marketed South Africa well.
They put South Africa on the map of every front page in the world, and we are on the lips of billions of people around the world.
It is the Springboks' fourth Webby Ellis Cup after winning it in 1995, 2007 and 2019. Springboks captain Siya Kolisi described the victory as something that non-South Africans will never understand.
It's not just about the game on the field. You know, our country goes through such a lot, and we are that bearing hope that they have.
Thousands are now preparing to welcome the team back home, possibly on Thursday. The team is expected to tour different cities across the country to show their appreciation for national support and present the trophy to the nation. Reporting for VOA News in Johannesburg, I am Tuso Kumalo.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I am David Vandy in Washington. For all the latest development on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer Kwame Ofori, our engineer Cornelius Tenor, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.